Welcome to Fire and Security Chat, brought to you by Corson Fire and Security, where we talk about the technology and equipment used to protect and secure life and property. I'm your host, Aaron Whitaker, and today I'm with Chris White, Clean Agent Corporate Trainer at Corson Fire and Security. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Aaron. How are you?
Good. On today's episode, I'm going to be talking to you about CO2 suppression systems. Mm-hmm. All right, CO2 suppression systems. I guess the first question probably people ask is it dangerous?
Yeah, actually, it can be. So you can actually become what they call asphyxiated. In other words, overcome, if you will, from the CO2 at about 7.5%. So what that basically means is our bodies, kind of a real quick synopsis, kind of how it works. So our hemoglobin in our bodies likes to absorb CO2 in the blood. Well, that's what helps us breathe in. So we're breathing in oxygen, exhaling the CO2, that whole process. So as you're getting exposed to a CO2 environment, you're going to breathe in your hemoglobin and all that inside your blood cells and all that type of thing. It just naturally wants to absorb more CO2. Mm-hmm. So as that process is happening, as you're trying to breathe in, your body's naturally trying to breathe in deeper, you're breathing in more CO2. So you can actually, and that's caused the asphyxiation. In other words, you're basically suffocating. So at 7.5%, that actually could happen to somebody. At get above 30%, it's very short period of time. It can be absolutely very, very deadly to you. We're starting out for regular, just run-of-the-mill, dumping CO2 in an enclosure, we're starting out 34%.
Oh, wow.
It's a fantastic fire suppression agent because it's cheap, it's plentiful. There's so many different various, it's very flexible in the design, but it is not a life safety agent. So, yeah, kind of a long answer to your question. Yes, it can be dangerous.
Okay. You've already kind of explained it. Why use it instead of clean agent?
So the way the industry is kind of going now, and it's going to be a little bit of ad lib, so it's not going to be word for word right out of the NFPA standard. But basically right now it is, if a clean agent fire suppression system like your FM200 or NOVAC or an inert gas can be used in lieu of CO2, they really want you, and I say they, the industry, at AHJs, authority having jurisdictions, that type of thing, they want you to use the clean agent.
Okay.
Where CO2 comes in to play, where clean agents are not that effective, is your dry, high voltage, dry electrical rooms, trenches, fur vaults, storage vaults that can have like a lot of bulk paper, or dust collectors. Those are considered or could be considered deep-seated. Clean agents do not do very well with deep-seated fire. So a deep-seated fire, it's a slow smoldering. Mm-hmm. So take a dust collector, which are probably one of the most volatile protections out there. You have the filters, and you had a couple of different style of dust collectors, but they both work really the same way. They're taking the byproduct of whatever the grinding or process is and filtering it in through a ductworking system into the dust collector. And the dust is settling, being filtered through and settling in these containers in the bottom of the dust collector.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that fine particulate, that fine dust, is highly flammable.
Yeah.
So it does not take very much at all for it to cause an ignition. So it could sit there and be smoldering and then finally ignite to the point where it's a full-fledged fire. With CO2, that kind of design for a deep-seated, instead of the 34%, we're at 75%. So CO2, there's a lot of flexibility with it. So if you had, let's say you had an enclosure and it was a high voltage, and for whatever reason you could not shut down the electronics, CO2 may actually be the smarter option because of the high voltage, whereas a clean agent you know, you're getting above the low L and no EL. It's just not going to be, it's just not going to be that effective on suppressing. So CO2 is very prominent, especially in your manufacturing and production facilities. CO2, you can also do a what they call a local application. So before I go in, I probably need to explain kind of the basics of the four different designs that you can kind of do with CO2. So the first one, I kind of mentioned it earlier, the first one that's the most simplest, it's kind of think of the terms like a clean agent. You've got a room, you're just dumping the agent inside the room. We're starting out at 34%.
Okay.
So if we had a flammable, for an example, a flammable storage room, and there's six different chemicals in that flammable storage room, we need to look at what the chemicals are. And if for some reason, I don't know, it was, and again, I don't have the chart right in front of me because I don't have it memorized. But let's say you had, I don't know, JP8 jet fuel. I think its starting design concentration is 36%. That's what, if that was the worst case being protected, that's what we need to start at. But we're just dumping CO2. Just dumping CO2 in the enclosure, reaching that design concentration, you're done. The other one is a total flood, and I mentioned it earlier, was a deep-seated. So from 0 to 2,000 or 2,000 and greater for anything dry electrical, high voltage, basically anything like over 480 volts, and it can't be shut down, we're starting out at 50%. We get into trenches, bulk paper storage, where it could be, again, considered deep-seated, we're now at 65%. And then you get into the dust collectors where it's 75%. And it's to ensure that there's enough CO2 because of, again, the slow smoldering nature of the deep-seated fire.
Okay.
And then you have two more, which are called local application. So you have local application rate by area, local application rate by volume. Between the two local applications, rate by area is the easiest one to design. Because it is a, we're not trying to protect in an enclosure. You may have a piece of equipment or a conveyor belt or something. You're just really protecting the equipment. So with total flood, it's the vapor and the liquid that's all kind of attributing to the entire design concentration. Local application, so you start seeing the CO2 system discharge and you start seeing a little bit of that white cloud, if you will, that's probably just vapor. It has nothing to do with the design. We want liquid flow, pounds per minute, coming out of each nozzle. So depending on the flow is depending on what kind of nozzle is being used, how far away or close it is to the protected equipment, and then we're just discharging onto a piece of equipment. Flat surfaces. So you could have a conveyor belt with just, you know, whatever your widgets on the conveyor belt, being dipped in some kind of coating, whatever, you're protecting the conveyor belt, you're dumping CO2 on it. Then your rate by volume is going to be more of a 3D type, maybe like a generator sitting outside that needs to be protected or whatever. Again, it's liquid flow of actual CO2 coming out of the nozzles. It's still a local application, but there's some imagination, if you will. There's some things in the design that are allowed of adding imaginary walls, those type of things, with the rate by volume, but it's still the same premise. Again, you're protecting a piece of equipment, not necessarily the enclosure. And the other thing with CO2 on total flood that you can't really do with clean agent is if you're protecting an enclosure, if you have unclosable openings that for whatever reason cannot be sealed up, there's calculations because of the way CO2 is, you can compensate for those unclosable openings to so you're still reaching your proper design concentration, even though you've still got openings that can't be closed. You can't do that with clean agent.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like on the localized applications where it's not, is the design concentration still? I mean, that's not attainable, is it?
No.
Because of the, you know, there's nothing to contain the...
Right. So you're going to see, like I said, on conveyor belts, dip tanks, rolling mills, you know, you can get on YouTube and see all sorts of, you know, you can, you know, like I said, YouTube the rolling mill fire, you know, those are going to be local application type. And so you're dumping onto the equipment. CO2 is, I mean, it's going to drift into other areas.
Right.
So because CO2 can be dangerous in the fact that, and the way it's kind of similar to clean agent is it's colorless, odorless, leaves no residue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, CO2 is also 1.5 times heavier than air. Well, if you can't see it, you can't taste it, you may be walking into an area because it's drifted into a low-lying area, and all of a sudden you're starting to feel a headache, nauseous. You're generally not feeling very good. You're probably getting exposed, or you may be getting exposed to higher concentrations of CO2, and that's what your body is telling you, you know, that, hey, something ain't right here.
Mm-hmm.
But so everybody thinks, you know, for example, oh, you know, you see the white clouding, if you will. Well, what's really generally happening is you're about a negative 110 degrees discharging at the discharge nozzles, no matter if it's total flood or local application. That kind of quote unquote white clouding that you see is really the ice particles being so cold, quickly basically cooling the atmosphere in and around. So that's kind of why you see, quote unquote, the white clouding on a discharge.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of it is CO2 in and of itself.
Just like opening your refrigerator.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But yeah.
Or your freezer, I guess. Yep. Yeah.
But CO2 is in its natural form, is colorless, odorless. It's not going to leave a residue. You could be in a CO2 environment and you really wouldn't have any idea.
So I guess the next question would be, what precautions or what accessories or appliances are used to warn people of CO2?
So back in 2005, NFPA 12, the standard for CO2 fire extinguishing systems, in 2005 was the first edition that they really started implementing life safety devices. There had been some events that led up to that, to actually that unwanted CO2 discharges that actually caused some pretty significant deaths. And it kind of caught the attention of the industry. So they came back and said, you need to, so if you're going to have a occupied or occupiable enclosure and you're doing a total flood CO2, then you need to have or shall have pneumatic sirens, pneumatic time delays, supervised lockout valves, and safety maintenance switches.
Mm-hmm.
Local application, you may only need supervised lockout valve. Maybe you need an odorizer. It depends on the drifting of the, you know, the CO2. So they've actually, you know, said this was one of those things where, because they changed the date 2 or 3 times, you know, they gave a specified date as to when all this was supposed to happen. The problem is a lot of jurisdictions, and this is going to sound like, you know, me bashing fire marshals or insurance, and that's further from the truth. Those individuals have a very tough job, especially, you know, I mean, not only looking at suppression systems, but they've got the building code that they got, you know, all sorts mm-hmm. of different things, what kind of building occupancy. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on when they walk into a facility. So there's no way in the world one individual can be that educated on everything. Yeah. The reason I mention that is it has been, even today in 2019, it has still been very, very slow to accept that the life safety devices may need to be required. So again, it could be pneumatic sirens, pneumatic time delays, supervised lockout valves, and maintenance switches. Supervised lockout valves should be on every CO2 system, bar none. It will not keep the system from discharging. In other words, what I'm saying is it won't keep the, if an alarm condition were to happen and the system dumped, it's not going to keep the release device from activating and the cylinders emptying. But if you had somebody in an enclosure doing maintenance, you've got that supervised lockout valve closed. Okay, the system is activated. The sirens and those type of things are going off. But as long as you got that valve closed, CO2 is not going to be able to dump. Now, at some point in time, you're going to have to open up that supervised lockout valve because you're going to have to dump the CO2. I mean, it's just, you're going to have to get it out of the manifold.
What is the valve? Is it a button or is it
No, it's an actual physical, kind of like wafer valve. So when you close it, it's physically closing the entire piping network between between the CO2 storage and, in this case that I'm actually kind of speaking of, is high pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably ought to describe the differences there here in a minute. But so you got that valve closed. The cylinders could still empty, but because that valve's closed, you're not allowing CO2 to come out of the nozzles.
Okay.
It's really a life safety device. Yeah. I mean, that's why they're being required. So with your pneumatic siren wouldn't activate until you still may have bells and horns going ring-a-ding-a-dingy before the system activates. But the pneumatic siren's only going to activate once CO2 has been released out of the agent containers. Your pneumatic odorizer, there's a wintergreen smell. Because CO2 is colorless and odorless and doesn't leave a residue, you, again, like I said earlier, you could be walking into a CO2 environment and not even realize it. Well, there's now the one lung man, if you will, that are specific to areas. So if you happen to be walking in through an area and you knew back behind you somewhere was the CO2 system and you heard something but you really didn't know what it was, and all of a sudden you start smelling wintergreen and you see the one lung man saying basically, hey, you smell wintergreen, get the heck out of that, CO2's in the area.
The one lung man being a sign that.
All the signs have to meet the same criteria now.
Okay.
So on CO2, you have two storage types. You have what they call high pressure, which are stored in the cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
And the general industry is, if you need more than 4,000 pounds of CO2, then you're really going to want to now go what they call a low pressure system. So it's going to be in a larger bulk tank, generally outside.
Mm-hmm.
So with high pressure, once the cylinders are told to open up, the valves are told to open up, they're open. It's like a clean agent. It's told to open, there is no stopping it. With low pressure, there's actually a control valve on top of the bulk tank that you can actually shut and control the flow of CO2. Your low pressure is going to be, again, your larger or very multiple shot, multiple design. It's a simpler way to, instead of having, you know, gobs and gobs of cylinders for various different locations where you can have it all one centralized and it can be piped and controlled through control valves and all that. So you can discharge into different areas, but you've got one large bulk tank. With high pressure CO2, at least every 12 years, they've got to be emptied and hydrostatically tested. Low pressure, there really isn't any test. So you need it refilled, call Corson. We'll get somebody out there and get it refilled for you, and you just keep on keeping on, and, you know. So there's pros and cons to, there's pros and cons to both systems, just depending on what the application is.
Okay. I just wanted to jump real quick. When we were talking about the non-enclosure integrity or the the CO2 systems with around generators and those types of things. What is that, localized or?
Local application.
Yeah, local application. Is that similar? I know there's CO2 fire extinguishers. Mm-hmm. And CO2 fire extinguishers, is that kind of the same idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so your fire extinguishers are more considered what they call, I guess, streaming, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, you know, depending on your fire and the size of your fire extinguisher, you know, there's a certain way of pointing that fire extinguisher to, you know, if you've done like a live burn test, you know, you've had Corson come out and do the live burn test and you're outside and you're putting out the pan fire, you know, they'll tell you with this type of extinguisher, this is where you need to aim. It's kind of the same principle with CO2. Well, if you get too close, you could actually cause that liquid to splatter. Well, it's the exact same concept with CO2 with local application. You know, I know you mentioned generator earlier, but with a dip tank, we got to make sure that those nozzles in the proper, because of the flow, if they're too close and the flow of liquid CO2 is too high, we could actually cause, so if you've got some kind of dipping oil cause unduly splashing, it could splash out, and all of a sudden your hazard has expanded when you actually not necessarily you, but somebody caused the issue because it wasn't, the nozzles were too close.
Okay. Is there any special training required for staff who work around CO2 suppression systems?
You know, it's being really, really pushed. I don't know how many times over the years where either I've been in the field working with techs or, you know, to make sure that I'm staying up to par and I'm actually doing work for a branch out in the field. And you show up and you start working on the CO2 system, and there could be a, you know, production line worker look at you and, you know, man, what you working on that? I don't know why you're working on that system, man. That thing, I don't think that thing's ever worked. And they're working right next to a CO2 system, and they're no word to the wiser.
Yeah.
It is absolutely, it is so, so incredibly important to have your personnel trained on the dangers and what CO2 really is. Even if you have a situation where you do not think CO2 or CO, you know, is not going to migrate to,
mm-hmm.
if there's a possibility you, and there's other individuals working in that area, they really, really need to be properly trained of what the effects are, and to the point where you have the proper signage. So what really should happen, you're having the CO2 system installed. What really should happen after the system's been installed, you should do a full discharge test. The reason why you really want to do that, number one, it's kind of multiple different things. You're ensuring that if it's total flood, you're reaching in, you know, because we have meters that we can meter mm-hmm. the actual design concentration, and there's time limits and, you know, those type of things that we're looking for. It's going to really tell us everything is designed properly, make sure mechanically everything is sound, and then local application, we can time out, making sure that we're reaching our proper liquid flow in the specified time, and plus, if CO2 is going to migrate, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to understand where it's migrating to, so it may migrate to areas that we didn't because of the construction of the building, right? The airflow of the building. It's just going to kind of drift where it's being, wherever the air is kind of taking it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, back to the previous, it's colorless, odorless. You may not realize. It is so incredibly important to ensure that your people are properly trained, and again, as to what CO2 is, how it can affect you, and what you should have a standing operating procedure on what should happen in the event if you have a CO2 system and it discharges. What do you want your personnel to do? Who responds? Where do they go? Those type of things. You know, there was an event many, many years ago in Idaho that, so real quick, they had 13 workers. They were doing a big, huge maintenance shutoff.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a dry electrical vault. So we're at 50%. So they had 40 100-pound CO2 tanks. So they're going to dump 4,000 pounds of CO2 into this dry electrical vault. That's what it took at 50% design.
Wow.
When it was all said and done, they had, I believe, 2 deaths because of asphyxiation from being exposed to the CO2. 2 or 3 were very seriously injured in the fact that they were still having issues a few days after the fact of trying to breathe because of the exposure to CO2. Had they had the simple supervised lockout valve, which at that time, because it happened around 1998, it had been mentioned, but it wasn't really required.
Mm-hmm.
Had they had that simple device and closed it out, when the system activated, they would have heard the sirens, actually heard the horn strobes, would have been able to evacuate. It would have never discharged. The other thing was they were very nonchalant. They were very just kind of, we're just going to do this. We'll be good to go. We've never had, you know, anything happen in maintenance. They just kind of, they didn't maintain the proper training, and they just took it kind of for granted. And unfortunately, that lack of training and taking it for granted, working in and around the CO2, when it started to discharge, they could not see. They had no warning.
Mm-hmm.
There was an electrical malfunction that occurred. They had no warning that it was discharging. They had aisleways lighting, very poor lighting, aisleways blocked with equipment. Jeez. Couldn't get to the doors. They couldn't see because of quote unquote the white fogging. Mm-hmm. Stumbling over equipment. I mean, there was all sorts of things, and it all stemmed from taking, you know, being very lackadaisical, but also not have proper training and understanding exactly what the system, how it was designed and what could happen. And had they had that simple training and stayed on top of that training, the two deaths probably, one or two deaths probably would not have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Last question I have is the supervised lockout valve. Mm-hmm. If I activate that or close it off, mm-hmm. you said that it won't, eventually you'll have to open it back up and let it, you know, let the CO2 dump out. If you go back to open it back up, are you given a certain amount of time to leave, or how do you open it and get out? I mean,
well, normally a lot, and so again, you're going to have to, it goes, again, it goes back to training. It goes back to your standing operating procedure at your facility. And if need be, you can always contact Corson. We'll be more than happy to either have the training center or your branch. Corson representation will be more than happy to come and discuss, you know, how the system functions, things to think about. We're not going to give you an SOP. You have to come up with your own SOP because mm-hmm. we're not there every day. But we're going to give you guidelines on how the system operates or what to do and those type of things. So if you get to that situation, if the cylinders are outside, for example, the enclosure, you just need to make sure there's all sorts of, there's no way anybody could enter that area, and you know, you open it up and let the CO, because the CO2 is coming.
Yeah.
Because you've already done opened up the valves. If it's inside, then you know that you really should have properly trained and properly fitted SCBAs. So you may have to have one or two individuals that have been properly trained and fitted for SCBAs. If the, for example, the high pressure cylinders are inside the area that's being protected, you may have to have them basically gear up and, you know.
SBA's breathing
apparatus. Basically like scuba.
Okay.
Yeah. Breathing apparatuses so they can continue to breathe if they're walking through the CO2 discharger. Yeah.
Okay. I just wondered about that. Yeah. It's like, yeah. All right. Also, we talked about CO2. Do they call it a suppression? Do they call it a dump? I mean, is that the word, or release, or activate? You
know. I mean, it's technically a release, but a lot of people say CO2 dump. You know, we're dumping CO2. You know, and it is. I mean, you can get on Corson's YouTube channel. We've got.
Well, actually, I was going to say, I try to find it on YouTube, and I think we need to add them on there. But if you go on Facebook, on our Facebook page, if you go to the videos. There's two videos. I checked it this morning. There's one from August 30th of last year and June 27th. And there are two dumps that we did here at the training center.
Yep.
And you're always doing those maybe once every few months or so for
about,
classes.
So we'll be doing it again in April for a training class. And then, you know, the next schedule one, I think, is like September, October, because that's when training classes are set up. But anytime we have, you know, any other training, whether it's AHJ, fire marshal, insurance, customers, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, if you've seen the videos, they're cool. And the beauty of it is when you – so some of the life safety devices that I've talked about is when you watch those – videos, mm-hmm. one of the reasons why we really, not only is it really cool to watch, right, and do, I have fun discharging them, but we have the actual life safety devices that we mentioned, you know, the pneumatic siren, pneumatic time delay, odorizer, supervisor, we have all those life safety devices on purpose on those systems. So if you've never seen them or don't quite understand what we're talking about, please watch the video because you will see the sequencing, especially the ones on that we discharge back in the hands-on. I purposely have programmed, in that instance, purposely programmed electronic time delay on the releasing control panel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Some of it is for training and safety factor because of the area that we're in. But once that electronic time delay expires, the release device is opening up the cylinders, so you'll start seeing the siren. Mm-hmm. Well, it still hasn't discharged. And the reason being is now it's running through the pneumatic time delay. So once it times out in the pneumatic time delay, it opens up. Now it's discharging. But again, it's a really good video, very simple form of seeing how the life safety devices actually operate and kind of what it sounds like and what it kind of looks like. You know, no, the systems back there are not properly designed for the area. We just, you know, we install them, we discharge them. It's really for people to understand what they're, you know, what they're dealing with. But again, from the life safety standpoint, it mm-hmm. kind of gives you the understanding of the devices.
All right. Well, yep. So go to Facebook, go to our page, and go to videos, and you can check it out. It's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
I think that's all the questions I have. You have any? No.
I just hope you enjoy these podcasts. It's fun to share the information, and if you do listen to them or know about them, know somebody that needs to listen to them, please don't hesitate to send them our way. But also, if you have any questions on anything we've talked about or any other discipline for that matter, please don't hesitate to reach out to our marketing team, and we'll be more than happy to either do a podcast and reach out, or you know, sometimes reach out to you directly and see what we can do to try to answer your questions.
And if you're curious, more curious about learning more about CO2 suppression systems, whether it's good for your, you know, your application, you can contact your local branch or Corson in the corporate headquarters. I think that's about it.
Yep.
Thanks for joining me, Chris.
And, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. That'd be it.
All right, thanks,
bye. Guys. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast and rate us on iTunes. You can also find our podcast on Spotify, Pocket Cast, Google Podcast, and other popular podcast players. Search for Corson Fire and Security Chat to find it. Thanks once again for listening, and I will see you next week for our next episode of the Corson Fire and Security Chat podcast. Have a great day, everybody. Bye. The information in this podcast is for informational purposes only. It is believed to be reliable, but Corson Fire and Security assumes no responsibility or liability for any errors or omissions in the content of this podcast. It does not constitute professional advice. The listener of this podcast is responsible for verifying the information's accuracy from all available sources, including the product manufacturer. The authority having jurisdiction should be contacted for code interpretations.